Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
So today's topic is we're going to have a part two of a conversation that we started last week, and it revolves around treating the COVID-19 positive patients in place in our post-acute and long-term care facilities. Today we're going to focus on the pharmaceutical management, but what I wanted to start with quickly is just doing a state of the state, making sure we are all aware of where we're at. I'm pretty sure we are. Things are changing so rapidly, so even some of the information that I'm sure I have up will be out of date within an hour or two. I also want to go over a CMS update that came out on April 2nd and a literature review, an article that's been getting a lot of attention, and I appreciate everyone who sent me the article. When we go over it, I'll let you know where, if you haven't seen it, where you could download it at. Then we'll go into a pharmacy deep dive and have time for open discussion. And the last item on the agenda is a quick review of telehealth. It's just a slide that I want to make sure you have available. It's sort of the quick review is sort of what I'm going to be calling our appendix. And if we have time after we get some questions around pharmacy answered and have those discussions, we can touch on any other questions we have around telehealth. So if you would proceed to the next slide, Shane. So this is just a snapshot of the states that are reporting cases of COVID-19. This was last updated on April 7th, because I've never shared this with you. This is the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center, and we use it a lot in United Healthcare just to get our most up-to-date data. The number of confirmed cases at the time this was taken was 399,929 throughout the U.S. That number is now over 400,000. That update just came a few minutes ago. So this just gives you a really good picture. It's open to everyone. You can go on to it, look at what's happening in the United States, and then go through and get details by state, where you can see the total recovered versus the total deaths in that that state. And it just gives you a lot of great information. In Florida, we have 14,747 cases, the majority of those cases being in Miami-Dade, who's now over 5,000, and Broward, who's over 2,000 cases. You know, we were able to get some information on mortality rates by age, and it is not shocking that we're seeing the highest mortality rates in our 85 plus age range. For hospitalization rates, I just wanted to point out that we are seeing hospitalizations across the entire age spectrum, from those infants and newborns who unfortunately have contracted this virus, to the age population that we're seeing. The significant amount of hospitalizations are for those 85 plus year old patients, but we are seeing it across everywhere in the state of Florida. The COVID-19 health data org, this is the projections data, and I shared this last week. This information is updated daily. So this was from 8:57 a.m. this morning, and it's showing that the United States will peak around April 11th through April 13th, with peak resources being used by April 13th. What that means is that we'll be requiring somewhere around 95,000 beds. That could be on the low end, is 41,000 in that range. As you see, the dotted line represents the number, but it could range even higher to over 200,000 beds being required. For the ICU beds, we are projecting that there is going to be a requirement around 19,816 beds by April 13th. And that could also increased it to as high as over 40,000. And the vents, we're projecting that we're going to need over 16,000 ventilators by April 13th. So on the next slide, we have some specific data for Florida. And if you're in a different state, we welcome you to our call. I want to make sure you know that you can find your state's information here too. The link, the COVID-19healthdata.org, you can look at every state and just figure out where you're at with the peak. This is showing hospitals. So we then have to think about how long will we see this surge, how many weeks or days before we start seeing the surge in the nursing facility. For Florida, you know, the good news is that we, with some of the social distancing initiatives that have gone in place, we are not seeing a longer period of time. If you recall and look at the handout from last week, you know, we thought that we were going to see a significantly higher number at the end of the month. They're thinking that our peak will be around April 21st, which means by April 15th, we're going to need somewhere around 7,000 hospital beds, with a high possibly of 17,000. The projection is that we'll need 1,200 ICU beds, possibly 2,900 at the high end, and for ventilators, we'll probably need around somewhere between 1,000 to 2,500 ventilators. Like I said, the good news is that we're seeing some flattening of this peak. The projections had us very much higher last week before some other initiatives for stay-at-home orders went into effect in this state. If you proceed to the next slide, this is the CMS update. And the CMS update came out on April 2nd. And it's really something that I think we've all been aware of. If you've been on any of our webinars or any of the other state chapters webinars, or even attended the AMDA conference, which had amazingly wonderful COVID-19 presentations, you are probably already doing some of these initiatives, but CMS came out with some guidelines and guidance around what the long-term care facilities need to do, with the first one being that the nursing home should immediately make sure that they're complying with all CMS and CDC guidance related to infection control. So that means that all of those, the updates that we've been discussing for the CDC, we really need to make sure our facilities are ready and able and getting ready to do this and go and start these initiatives as far as cohorting patients and suspected cases and those things, and making sure that they adhere to the infection control guidance that the CDC has published. As far as the second one, you know, it is really urging that the state and local leaders consider the needs of the long-term care facilities with respect to supplies for personal protective equipment, as well as COVID-19 testing. And they recommend that the states get together with your stakeholders, make sure we are identifying all of the issues and the needs of the facilities. And I could definitely attest that this is something that we're doing in Florida. We did have a stakeholders call last week where we were able to get on and talk with our emergency medical team, the Florida Hospital Association, and those. And if you're in another state, I would really encourage you to talk to your local and state leadership in that manner, whether it's through the chapter organization or through another venue. We really need to make sure we understand what is about to hit our facilities. The third thing that they recommended is to immediately implement symptom screening for all residents. So that means that, you know, according to the CMS guidance and CDC guidance, every resident should be screened. Whether you're doing on the vital checks daily, you're looking at who has a fever, anyone has symptoms, anyone with recent visitors. We've already seen across the many of the states, including Florida, that there are stricter visitation rules that have been implemented in the nursing facility. So, you know, I think on that part, we are all, we've all accepted that guidance, but they should still all be screened. They also want to make sure that the staffs and the facilities are using appropriate personal protective equipment and to really adhere to the CDC guidance and create contingency strategies around preserving personal protective equipment. There was a webinar today that the Florida Healthcare Association completed about how to don and take off personal protective equipment. That webinar will be made available to everyone here and our membership. We're going to include it on our website in the next day or two. It was a really good overview of what we need to do to make sure that we are safely utilizing this equipment and how we can preserve the PPE that we have, as well as the discussion about burn rates. How do you track and monitor how fast you're going through the PPE? The fifth thing is something I think that we are all aware of as well, and it was really how to avoid transmission, separating staff for any of the suspected cases and COVID-19 positive cases that you have. The fact that those patients need to be cohorted to a specialized unit, and that the staff needs to be separated out. So I think it's something that we're all aware of. CMS just put it down as part of their guidance for all long-term care facilities. If you go to the next slide, I just wanted to just hit on this paper. It is, you know, I do appreciate everyone who was able to send us this paper. It is a very good, a very detailed overview of what we need to prepare for. It really goes through some of the recommendations I think we're already considering about having the specialized post-acute units to cohort patients, including telemedicine and our daily rounding, and looking at getting those facilities to assure that the patients are being tested for COVID-19 prior to being discharged to the SNF. We know that that's not consistently going on in every area, but it is a recommendation that came out of this paper. And if you show the map on the following slide, the reason why I think that is important is, you know, it really took a look at where we're going to see our surge, which we're all preparing for. You know, this is just a map of all the beds, you know, that they've documented since 2019 for SNF beds. So potential for not only for us to get the COVID-19 patients, we already knew that that was there, but it just sort of brings home the fact that this is something that if we don't take the right steps and prepare ourselves correctly, we could see further waves of COVID-19 outbreaks throughout the country. And with that, I am going to turn it over to Dr. Rick Foley. Dr. Foley is a consultant pharmacist for CVS at OmniCare. He is a member of the Florida Medical Directors Association Board of Directors, and he's a board-certified geriatric pharmacist. He teaches the initial certification course for consultant pharmacists for the University of Florida College of Pharmacy, and he has led multiple strategic initiatives with Florida Medical Directors Association. I'm sure he's always willing and waiting to lead another one. So with that, I turn it over to Dr. Foley to go into a pharmacy deep dive.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
Thank you, Dr. Sanders Cepeda, for that introduction. And no, I am not looking for more work, so ignore that last bit. So jumping into the pharmacy deep dive, next slide, please, Shane. There's just a few basics that today and, you know, going into the COVID outbreak kind of reminds us of where we need to be anyway. But if you have not done these five things, and you listen to nothing else I say today, these are the five things that absolutely need to happen from a pharmacy perspective. If you don't have good lines of communication between your pharmacist, your consultant pharmacist specifically, and your pharmacy, make sure that happens. The pharmacy relies heavily on the communication between the nursing home and, by default, the medical director, director of nursing, and all of the staff to make sure that they can meet your needs and anticipate the best way they can your needs and going forward. Secondly, be aware of prescribing requirements and restrictions ahead of time. Just for example, hydroxychloroquine, although there are no legal prescribing requirements right now, most consultants are reporting back to me that pharmacies are requiring the diagnosis of COVID positive, not just prophylaxis. I'll cover that in just a few minutes. I'm also being told Tamiflu is being restricted, as well as azithromycin. So just know those ahead of time. If you don't know, have your director of nursing call, or even better yet, call your consultant pharmacist and they will get that information for you. The next thing is review your emergency ordering procedures. Know when the cutoff times are for routine meds. Know how you get meds from the pharmacy after hours, the timelines that those take, and the process that needs to occur to get those meds in a timely manner. Review your emergency kit, or if you're lucky, you have an automated dispensing unit with more stock. Review the contents. Have those printed out somewhere so that in the event that you need to treat someone, you know what you have on hand, and that may eliminate the need, at least the initial need, to go through emergency backup procedures. Also, we're seeing this evolving almost on a day-to-day basis, and this is not something you need to run out and do right now, but just remember, the FDA, CDC, the World Health Organization all recommend limiting aerosol-generating treatments for COVID-positive patients. Now, in a hospital, we have negative pressure rooms, but in a nursing home, those are going to be rare at best. So we need to figure out, in the event that we have a COVID-positive patient, can they be switched to a metered-dose inhaler? If you don't know how to pull those lists, talk to your consultant pharmacist, talk to your medical records, DON. In point-click care, that's the order listing report. It's very easy to pull. So that needs to be figured out, how you pull that information ahead of time. So jumping into the actual management, I've never had more questions about Plaquenil, hydroxychloroquine, in my entire career than I've had in the last week. So these are the, and I'm using the air quotes, recommended. This is the guidance given by the FDA and the CDC on treatment algorithms, regimens. And again, these are fluid and based on studies that come out almost daily. I know there are at least a handful going on the treatment of COVID-positive patients in the hospital. The pre- and post-exposure prophylaxis regimens are still being studied, but with no data. But right now, based on the emergency proclamation from the FDA, they have recommended 800 milligrams on day one, followed by 400 milligrams daily for 4 to 7 days. And that's going to depend completely on the response. If you have a good response, obviously, you're going to extend that out. Now, keep in mind, these were only authorized for hospital, but again, we're talking about the post-acute environment where not only do they don't do a lot of studies, but the data just is not there yet. So again, we're going to have to be good clinicians and use the risk-benefit and determine if this is going to be something that our patients can benefit from. We'll talk about risks in just a minute. The CDC also recommends several regimens, 400 twice a day, then 400 daily for 5 days. And there's a couple others that you can read there. Azithromycin, now the open label study from France that came out, they kind of got all of this going from the president on down to the local clinician and adding azithromycin. There wasn't any clear and compelling evidence that said why this works. They just think that it decreases viral load. So in the study that was published in France, this was part of the regimen. We'll talk why that may be a good or bad idea, but again, it's standard ZPAC dosing that they used, which, as you remember, is 500 on day one, then 250 for days two through five for a total of 5 days of therapy. So those are the regimens. Now, what are some of the risks? Now, you've probably heard this to death, but you're going to hear a little bit more. It's QTC prolongation. The recommendation is that you monitor throughout treatment, baseline and throughout treatment. What that means in practice, not sure, because we're only talking about 7 days of therapy, but baseline is essential. It is contraindicated to anybody who has QTC prolongation existing, as well as visual and retinal field disturbances, et cetera. But just keep in mind that, like with any other drug, our patients will experience those side effects first, and they have the most complex drug regimens. So they're already likely taking QTC prolonging medications. A very brief, nowhere near exhaustive list includes things like azithromycin, which we just mentioned was used as a co-medication for treatment. Other macrolides included with those, also the quinolones, which that's levoquin, and the fluconazole and ketoconazole. Tricyclic antidepressants. If you've ever heard me speak on any topic whatsoever, you've heard me talk about the ills of tricyclic antidepressants. Well, add this to the list of reasons why we shouldn't use them. Doxepin, amitriptyline, imipramine. Other meds, the class 1 and class 3 antiarrhythmics, amiodarone, dronedarone, sotalol, lecanide, econide, quinidine, etc. Antipsychotics, if you're still using Haldol for treating delirium dementia, here's a really good time to get rid of it. Quetiapine and olanzapine also. Some other meds include the Alzheimer's med donepezil, celostazole, methadone, even meds like Zofran and Lexapro and Celexa all have QTC prolonging risk to them. Other things you need to think about are electrolyte abnormalities, specifically potassium and magnesium abnormalities. And so these are going to be an issue in anybody that's getting a diuretic. Now, obviously, that's a lot of our patients. So those need to be dealt with prior to the initiation. Other risk factors, obviously, people over the age of 65 and female risk, being female is a risk factor as well. So there's a growing body of evidence that says that there's significant renal and hepatic dysfunction acutely and post-infection, and we do not know how long this lasts. We know that obviously the more severe the infection, the more involved the COVID infection means a longer recovery, but those are being reported in an outpatient basis. We don't have any real post-acute or long-term care data, so we have to assume that these impairments, dysfunctions of the end organs are going to continue weeks and even into months. And this will increase our risk for kinetic and pharmacodynamic interactions with pre-existing treatments. And we'll talk about what we can do to mitigate some of that in just a minute. So other medication considerations, you know, you've probably heard lots of data out there and a lot of anecdotal information on what does and what does not work. And we do know that the protease inhibitors, for example, ritonavir, have no benefit in COVID-19. It's been studied a few times. There's been a few papers printed, and we know that there is no benefit whatsoever to those, at least none that has been published. The other idea with the IL-6 pathway inhibitors, things that would maybe treat rheumatoid arthritis due to the cytokine storm, there's been anecdotal reports only. Trials are ongoing, but these are extraordinarily expensive medications and should really be only used at a very last resort and likely only in a hospital ICU setting. There has been some information out there that somehow ACE inhibitors increase your risk, and there's speculation because the COVID uses the ACE transport system to infect the body, that somehow the ACE inhibitors would be improve or somehow impending the recovery or increasing likelihood. There's absolutely no data to support this. So the ACCA, AHA, et cetera, have issued statements recommending that we continue for patients that are have been taking ACE inhibitors for heart failure, hypertension, or ischemic heart disease. Now, immunotherapies are a little bit different. So obviously, those are going to be done on a case-by-case basis, prednisone all the way to the more potent. immunosuppressives, really have to take those on a severity level and evaluate those on a risk-benefit basis. We talked about the nebulizers in patients that are COVID positive and people under that we suspect may be exposed. Change your nebulizers to non-aerosol generating therapies whenever possible. When not possible, keep in mind that there are CDC recommendations about donning personal protective equipment for aerosolized protection, droplet precaution for those patients or those caregivers. NSAIDs, obviously, if you read the news, you've heard that NSAIDs are apparently giving young people COVID virus. That's absolutely not true. However, there's always been a body of evidence that supports the uses of acetaminophen as first line for fever. NSAIDs and COX-2s can be continued on a case-by-case basis based on prior illness, prior treatment, but not for the treatment of a fever first line unless there's a compelling indication as why you might do that. Next slide. So deprescribing, that one of my favorite things to talk about, unfortunately I have to talk about in the context of COVID-19. So as we evaluate these patients, particularly renally cleared medications, or really any medication, you really have to look at what is my risk benefit. And typically we'll look at medications and say, okay, what is my risk benefit for 2 years, 4 years, 10 years, depending on your patient's condition. We really have to think about what is my risk benefit over the next 4 to 6 weeks, or maybe 2 to 3 months. That's the time frame we really need to think about. And this is really due to the lack of information that we have out there. We don't know how our patients are doing post-exposure. We don't understand exactly what's involved in the end organ dysfunction. So we really need to go back and look and say, is this something that the patient can go without for 6 or 8 weeks? And generally that answer is going to be yes, if it's severe enough. So what particular medications are on that top of that list? Obviously the narrow therapeutic window meds, digoxin, if you're still using lithium, obviously that's renally cleared electrolyte and needs to be considered. Vancomycin, aminoglycosides. Ensure the pharmacy knows that the patient is COVID positive or is COVID exposed, that they may have some underlying renal dysfunction that might not be showing up in labs just yet. Other meds, metformin, I want to mention the DPP-4 inhibitors, the gliptins, that's Januvia. Keep in mind that hydroxychloroquine actually decreases insulin clearance and decreases insulin resistance. So your risk of hypoglycemia goes through the roof when you use hydroxychloroquine. So when you have that prescribed, know that you'll have to be monitoring for your fasting blood sugars, and that's 3 to 4 times a day, and really consider holding back on medications that lower the blood sugar, particularly on those that have a historical use of a glucagon or have to have insulin held. Again, we're not really worried about A1Cs right now. It's the risk of hypoglycemia that will really trump any benefit to those. Gabapentin, pregabalin, the Bigatran, which is Pradaxa, benzostatins, and we mentioned NSAIDs and COX-2. Again, this is not an exhaustive list. And when you go in and look at your patients, really do the risk benefit on as to why we're using it if they can be held. So non-essential medications, really look at that short and long-term risk benefit. And this is just a short list. If you ask me on any deprescribing patient, what will we do? Vitamins, OTC, and herbals. I had a patient yesterday, they were on 7 different vitamins and no documented deficiencies of any of the supplements. So it's really a good way to debride that drug regimen, scrape off a few layers. Then that's a good idea at any time, but especially now, not just to reduce the complexity of the drug regimen, but also maybe to save the nurse time that they're already having to deal with a stressed nursing staff. Acid reducing medications, cholesterol treatments, osteoporosis treatments, dementia treatments, appetite medications, et cetera, including mirtazapine, Marinol, Megace, et cetera. And we need to look at our limited duration medications, not just cough and cold, but your Lovenoxes, your antibiotics, things that may have been included on admission that maybe didn't get a stop date. So with that, I'll go back to Dr. Sanders Cepeda, and I think we'll have questions at the end. Thank you.
Yeah, so we do have a couple of questions that came in through the chat. One was, what is the consensus on the use of hydroxychloroquine? And I'm going to direct that back to you, Dr. Foley.
Yeah, so, wow, if I knew that, I'd probably write a great article on it. The right now, we don't know. There are so many studies going on, either from pre-exposure, post-exposure, prophylaxis, all the way to treatment in the acute and post-acute setting. Right now, it really needs to be a risk-benefit. In the post-acute setting, we're hoping that they're on the other side of an infection. But again, the list of side effects and potential damage is exhaustive. So it really needs to be something that you give a lot of thought to say, okay, I know it's only 7 days. I'm not really worried about end organ damage for 7 days. But again, you can have acute drug interactions. You can have hypoglycemia, which leads to falls and fractures, et cetera. So, you know, that answer may come out tomorrow or next week, but right now there isn't a consensus. Oh, and I just saw a question from Dr. Reyes. Something to consider an alternative to MDI with spacers? Absolutely. If you have someone that has cognitive impairment, they will not be able to use an MDI. The directions are difficult. Even for pharmacists, they don't even demonstrate the correct technique at times. So a spacer, which slows down the velocity of that aerosol to allow it to get into the lungs more naturally, absolutely essential. So use those spacers, keep them patient specific, obviously, but know who your patients need them and also maybe the ones who don't need them.
Could we use a spacer with the Opti chamber? It's just a recent question.
Yeah, an Opti chamber is just a different type of spacer. So, for an infant, yeah, it would be similar. The different sizes of aero chambers, the different sizes of spacers, they come in, there's 100 different. There's some that have masks on them. There's some that have the little whistle that tell you you're doing them right. If you don't know what your pharmacy has, you can either call your consultant pharmacist directly or the pharmacy to see what they have or how to order those.
And if I could go back to the consensus on the use of these medications, I think if there was anything else that we had to use, we probably would. I reviewed a few trials that are ongoing, like you mentioned, Dr. Foley, and the evidence I think there needs to be more investigation. But if there was something else that we could use, I don't know what you think, Dr. Foley, and we had available at our toolkit, we would probably lean on it. Currently, this is what we have. So we really do need to look at the risk versus the benefit for every case in which you may consider starting it. I don't think we're 100%, just pushing it as a cure-all because we know it's not. What I've seen, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Foley, I saw that one study in France showed that it may, the person after 7 days may test negative for the virus, and then with the addition of Zithromax after 6 days. But it was a very small sample size. The study had a lot of issues, and I think it was just something that we saw some promise, and one of the reasons why the FDA would have had to issue an emergency authorization.
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head, is that there's such little data, but the patients are already here. So we're trying to do a controlled study in the middle of an outbreak that is so rapidly changing that unfortunately we don't have time to do a placebo-controlled trial. We don't have the time to do it. So we're just going to have to be good clinicians in this, whether it's, deciding that the malarial prevention regimen is not appropriate, or saying that, hey, as Lauren Tafur points out, we have patients recovering in the hospital that did very well on hydroxychloroquine. Again, these are going to be individual clinician-based decisions that you're going to have to make. There's not a guideline that we can lean back on. The question is how are our supplies of hydroxychloroquine in Florida? Tenuous. We're not really certain right now because if you read a couple weeks ago, several manufacturers saying they were going to make 5, 10, 20 million tablets available. These were either going to the strategic national stockpile or going to the states directly, you know, not to the individual companies. I have not heard of a shortage, and I have not heard of any restrictions to this point on dispensing outside of the COVID positive diagnosis. But again, this could change tomorrow. We're hopeful that we get those supplies in from the manufacturers before a shortage starts. But it does look like that Florida is being, for the most part, judicious, at least in the hospital and post-acute area. Now, the retail side might be a different story.
When would you retest a COVID positive patient before he or she could go back to general population? Okay, I think I understand. So you would really need to follow the CDC guidance. There is some information on the CDC's website that if you have a person who known to have a positive test and you can retest them after, 7 to 14 days, if they're negative, then they can come off of isolation. If they've not been tested, then they should really go through the whole 14 days. I'm not sure if anybody else has any other information on that question. We also have a question. Can somebody comment about the potential use of universal COVID-19 testing in long-term care facilities for all residents, patients, as well as staff? Recently, a facility in Boston completed universal testing. As far as I know, I mean, I think that is something that we would really want to see happening, but it does vary depending on by state, depending on the availability of the test. There hasn't been a general consensus or a statement that's come down from the CDC or CMS that says that we should test everyone. The only guidance we have right now is that everybody needs to be screened. I am trying very hard not to miss any of these questions. Dr. Tafora said that our facility has options to test in SNF setting. They have to contact the local health department and they will come out and test the patients and the staff as well. So that's very good. And I would recommend going to your local county health department and seeing what they have available. And in Boston, yes, they did find that many of those residents were asymptomatic but were positive, which is something that I think we're seeing throughout the country. So the next comment is that it was reported by Governor DeSantis that a million doses of hydroxychloroquine was shipped to Tallahassee. Dr. Foley, I'm not sure if you know anything about that.
Yeah, we
I've not heard anything.
Again, this is going to be a government, probably Department of Health driven project and almost like a strategic stockpile that if we see a local county need, it will be shipped from there. I spoke to a few different pharmacies today. We haven't heard of any shortage. We also haven't heard of any update from the governor's office to determine how and if those will be shipped out to the individual dispensaries or it's going to be hospital only right now based on the CDC recommendation. But again, that could change literally by the end of the day. So if anything comes out, we'll of course pass that on.
Well, I thank you all for listening. And like I said, I know that there was a lot of questions about telehealth. You know, this was something that was sent over to me, the CMS toolkit, yesterday, just as, in the discussion. And I'm like, oh, I think we should include it in this presentation, just so that you guys have it again, the way that we could approach telehealth in our population. We remember all the rules have been lifted, so audio, FaceTime, any platform that you could do for telecommunications, you could utilize currently and do a Medicare telehealth visit. There's also the virtual check-in visits, and we have the HCPCS codes there. And then the e-visits are where you're doing it through an online patient portal. You can build those out as well. For the Medicare telehealth visits, you just have to make sure your place of service code is there. I haven't seen where you needed to have a modifier in that to build that code out. And I've been able to sort of shadow some people to see how they do it. And there wasn't any kickbacks to their EMRs when they build out and just use the place of service code. We will, we'll keep having these conversations on a weekly basis so that we can make sure that we're well prepared as we can be for what is coming. I thank you all.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.